Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Kevin Moore Show. I'm Kevin Moore, and it is a pleasure to be spending the next hour with you. Our opening musical selection was Promises, Promises, a wonderful song from the great composer Burt Bacharach. And that's what I have for all of you today, the promise that this next hour will be informative, interesting, provocative, and maybe even a little exciting. A promise that our discussions will give you something to think about today and hopefully something to talk about tomorrow. Or what I'd like to think of as a civilized hour of culture and conversation. Well, as I like to do to begin each of our shows, I like to read or share a recent poignant story or an especially interesting essay or some philosophical quotes or thoughts or sometimes even a little poetry that touches or speaks to us all. And it's about that time. Summer's over, or at least we'll be in a few days. By the calendar. So we thought we'd read one last gasp here, one last essay about summer, maybe even sneak in a little, one last Beach Boy song or two. But it's entitled Summer's Over, Hooray by Kevin McHugh. At last we're relieved of the duty to have all that fun. So here we are again, Kevin writes, in another summer's end. The kids are back in school, the beaches have closed, and the ballparks will follow in a few weeks. Each day ends a bit earlier, the light coming at sharper angles as the sun sets further and further to the south, and the air takes on hints of autumn crispness. With the season's passing comes the end of all those activities, picnics and barbecues, street festivals and art fairs, outdoor concerts and movies in the park, that just weeks ago seemed to offer endless amounts of sun-drenched fun. And not a moment too soon, because really, could we bear another week of knowing there was so much summertime fun you could be having? If only you had more time for it. Admit it, it's a relief that summer is over and you no longer feel pressured to take advantage of it. It's as much a part of the season as the Cubs raising hopes and then dashing them. That inevitable moment, somewhere in mid-July, when you think, where has the summer gone? With that thought comes the urgent sense that you must do something more with what's left of it. Get out on a boat, play more golf or tennis or softball, work in the garden or on your tan, but it's a losing battle. By then the days are already growing shorter. Within a few weeks, the 10 o'clock news with commercials for back-to-school sales and reports from football training camps foreshadows autumn's arrival, and it's downhill from there. Lost opportunities for summer enjoyment cause a particularly wistful kind of regret, as if they're somehow more precious than those of other seasons. Never mind, the truth be told, much of summer is best spent indoors. There's a reason we have air conditioning and mosquito repellent. Like all neuroses, the yearning for more summer recreation has its beginnings in childhood. Unless you were one of those unfortunate farm children for whom summer vacation was originally intended and spent May through August working in the fields, your summers were probably spent at the pool, at camp, and complaining that there was nothing to do. Remember when all you had to do all day was avoid the crushing burden of having to mow the lawn? Childhood establishes the precedent that summer is a months-long interlude of carefree leisure, and that shapes our expectations of the season long after adulthood teaches us otherwise. So, we're more annoyed than usual when we have to cancel an evening in Grant Park because there's too much work to do, or spend a July weekend stuck in our home office finishing up a report. As Eddie Cochran later sang, I'm going to raise a fuss, I'm going to raise a holler, but working out summer is just try to earn a dollar. We seem to forget that the demands of work and family and friendships don't stop from June to September. If anything, they increase. A colleague observes that there are only a dozen or so weekends in a given summer, and half of them are filled with christenings, graduations, weddings, and other social obligations. Meanwhile, the kids are off from school, and unless they're old enough for summer jobs, someone has to shepherd them to the pool and to camp. But given that your average 8-year-old's days are more heavily scheduled than the president's, at least they're less likely to moan, there's nothing to do. It's not that summer is no fun. A look back on my own calendar reminds me that I got to a few baseball games, ate some dinners at sidewalk cafes, and caught an outdoor concert where I rediscovered the serene pleasure of drinking beer out of a can on a summer afternoon. But somehow it seems, well, inadequate. The very overabundance of summer fun creates a no-win situation. No matter how much you do, you just can't do it all. Not with three different blockbuster movies opening each weekend and your neighborhood block party and drinks after work at that new beer garden. Still, we try to fit in as much of it as possible, with the result that everyone's so overextended that summer relaxation becomes yet one more source of stress. One friend of mine packed a circus performance, a barbecue, and a music festival into this past 4th of July. The following weekend, I found myself simultaneously scheduled to be at both a picnic with good friends whom I hadn't seen in months and my sister-in-law's birthday party. The traffic alone getting into many events is enough to make a person feel the end of summer can't come soon enough. Wouldn't it be easier to acknowledge that summer isn't more fun than the rest of the year? It's just more humid? Eddie Cochran was wrong. There is a cure for the summertime blues. It's called Labor Day. Summer's finally over. Now I can relax. A little pessimistic attitude by Kevin McHugh, but funny nonetheless. Summer's over. Hooray. At last, we're relieved of the duty of all that fun. Well, we can continue to have some fun. And maybe by playing a little Beach Boys. When records were 45s, a record came out called Wouldn't It Be Nice, and on the flip side was God Only Knows. We're going to play those right now. From the Beach Boys, Sounds of Summer. And we'll be back on The Kevin Moore Show.
As long as there are stars above you, You never need to doubt it. I'll make you so sure about it. God only knows what I'd be without you. If you should ever leave me, well, life would still go on, believe me. The world could show nothing to me. So what good would living do me? God only knows what I'd be without you.
Favorites from the Beach Boys' Sounds of Summer. We're back on the Kevin Moore Show. Signs of Life, A Tale of Terezin is thrilled to announce the full cast for Chicago premiere this fall at the Zacek McVeigh Theater at the Biograph, 2433 North Lincoln. Signs of Life will play Chicago for a limited six-week engagement September 18th through October 27th. Joining Lara Phillip as Berta and Jason Collins as Kurt are Nathan Cooper, Brennan Doherty, Matt Edmonds, Megan Long, Michael Joseph Mitchell, Doug Pollock, and James Rank. Signs of Life, a new musical drama based on the true story of the Czech ghetto Terezinstadt, tells one of the most fascinating and least known stories of the Holocaust. Originally founded by the Nazis, Terezinstadt was specifically designated for the academic and artistic Jews of Europe. In an attempt to deceive the Red Cross and sway public perception, the Nazis decided to beautify the ghetto and commission a propaganda film. Signs of Life shows the struggles of the captives of Terezinstadt as they try to expose the truth through art and music, and in doing so, discover the humanity they all share. Signs of Life is a story that must be told, and it's never been told quite this way before. It's an important story because it was an event of tremendous importance to Jewish, European, and Western history, and as such is still important today in knowing who we are and where we come from, said librettist Peter Uyulian. That said, living in a time as fraught as ours, a time of peril, violence, authoritarianism, sectarianism, and genocide, a story about people trying to hold on to what makes them human, to bear witness to horror, and to struggle to make difficult moral choices, has a strong contemporary resonance. And on the line with us right now is the award-winning director, having worked at the Goodman Theater, Timeline, Steppenwolf, Northlight, and the Guthrie Theaters, associate director of the Tony Award-winning musical Tommy, internationally recognized director of musical theater, head of the MFA directing program at the Theater School of DePaul University, one of the brightest stars in the world, Chicago Theater, and now directing the Chicago premiere of Signs of Life, A Tale of Terezin at the Zacek McVeigh Theater, at the Biograph, 2433 North Lincoln, through October 27th. Lisa Portis. Lisa, welcome to the Kevin Moore Show.
Thank you so much for having me. What a lovely introduction.
Well, you're very welcome. And certainly, what a significant and very fascinating story. I've never heard about, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Terezinstadt?
Yes, I mean, the Germans would pronounce it Theresienstadt, and the Czechs would pronounce it Terezin.
Terezin, right. And that's the town that was where this fortress was.
Yeah, it was originally a military town, and then it was transformed by the SS into a Jewish ghetto, essentially.
Kind of a fort that was built by the Austrian Emperor Joseph, named after Maria Theresa of Austria, and as you said, used as a fort for political prisoners and to accommodate military people, and then taken over by the Nazis. And this is a story that I don't know if a lot of people are familiar with. You know, we're familiar with the Kinder transport. We're familiar with, in fact, a couple of weeks ago we had on Mona Galabek, who was the pianist of Willesden Lane. She was at the Royal George Theater doing a show, just a terrific show. And certainly the stories that accompany this tragedy of the Holocaust, but not this particular story itself. What fascinated you? How did this come to be, and how did you put this all together, Lisa?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I was called by Peter Julian, the book writer, and I knew each other from in college, at Oberlin College many, many years ago, and he knew I lived in Chicago, and when he found out he was doing this, he called me up. And first I said, I'm going to do a musical about the Holocaust. Are you crazy? But, you know, what always attracts me as a director is when I stumble upon material, specifically historical material, that I don't know the story. And I did not, as you did not, know the story of Terezin, I think as many people did not. And it's fascinating because it's so, you know, they created this Jewish ghetto, housed most of the artists and intellectuals, the Jewish artists and intellectuals from throughout Europe and specifically Czechoslovakia, and then commissioned them to make it look pretty in order to make a film to fool the rest of the world about, you know, into thinking that these camps that they were creating, I mean, it's not just, you know, the City for the Jew doesn't, the movie doesn't just hide what's actually going on at Terezin, it hides what's going on in Auschwitz. And so it's fascinating. And then what's beautiful about the story is that then those artists who have been commissioned seek to find a way to revolt, really a way to change the course of history through smuggling out art that lets people know what's really happening.
You mentioned Auschwitz. Of course, a lot of these inmates were transferred then to Auschwitz and some of the Treblinka, too, I think, some of the other camps.
Yeah.
The idea was to get the point across to the Western people that there's a rich cultural life that they were providing for these people when just the opposite was true.
Absolutely. It was to certainly kind of put on a front that this was a city where the Jews could have a great time, go to a cafe, go to the theater, attend a concert, have soccer games, practice their religion, which was really all a front. You know, they weren't actually able to do most of those things, but when the Red Cross came, they certainly were. They even had, they even created curtains for the windows in the buildings, but they made them out of paper because the Red Cross trip was so short. It was actually about 6 hours that the Red Cross inspector was there. And so they managed, you know, they down to like paper curtains in the windows, tried to create this pretty picture in order, again, to hide the full scope of what was happening to the Jews. And what was interesting is right after the Red Cross inspection, the transports increased. So they were sending more and more people away right afterwards to try to liquidate the camps before, you know, before the they felt that the war was tipping against them.
And these were middle-class Jews from Germany and Czechoslovakia and Austria. Mm-hmm. And they formed a community themselves, just the opposite of what the Nazis expected. They formed a very tight bond.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I mean, I think one does. And I think in this, you know, interestingly, in this camp, there were more liberties than certainly in other ghettos, and certainly than in concentration camps, because they were housing not only the kind of literati, but they were also housing, for example, people who'd fought in World War, Jews who had fought in World War I, mm-hmm. were afforded a kind of special status if they were sent to Terezin. So there was different levels of what was possible. But listen, nobody was eating very well. You know what I mean? It was not by no means a kind of, you know, spa. But they did advertise it as a spa, which was amazing. They convinced many kind of older Jews to come by saying, oh, it's a spa. You'll be able to retire in comfort, and sold them, you know, a kind of bill of goods. And then they get there, and it was, you know, a ghetto.
And what did they do with the older Jews? They leave them there? They transfer them to the concentration camps also?
Well, the kind of nefarious thing is that the concentration camps could only take so many people at the same time. So the idea was that to transport the kind of older, frailer Jews to places like Theresienstadt, but then essentially starve them or hope that they die of typhus.
Oh. And you're making a musical out of it.
Absolutely.
I mean, in fun of it, I think it's kind of interesting, though. Of course, so did Mel Brooks, too, with the producers, right?
Absolutely. What's interesting is that, you know, the subject matter lends itself to not only theater but to music theater, because because it's about artists. It's about artists housed in these circumstances trying to make art that subverts the plans of the oppressor.
Would the common man be familiar with any of the inmates who became famous artists or musicians?
I don't think the common American man would at this point. I think maybe there are some Europeans that might remember a character that none of them are named. None of them are named after famous historic figures. They're all compilations, the characters in the piece. But there was a famous cabaret singer of the time. But you wouldn't recognize anybody specifically by name in this.
Well, let's do some research. One woman, though, who was Hannah Suitcase. Remember that story, that book,
yes.
Hannah Suitcase? I think she
yes.
was Hannah Brady. That was interesting. What did they do? How did they live day to day there?
Well, you know, many of them worked. They were given jobs, whether that's kind of working in the infirmary or building or doing latrine duty. I mean, they all worked. You know, it was a functioning, ghetto, and it had, a bakery and a post office and a hospital, and it all had to be maintained. And, of course, the SS officers' quarters had to be maintained, and their children had to be maintained. So everybody worked. And then they had, for food, accounts say that they had a half a loaf of bread to last a week, a very small, like a tablespoon of margarine. They would have kind of coffee, coffee made from coffee, used coffee grounds, saccharin, not sugar, and some kind of soup that from all accounts was inedible, and a potato. And that was kind of daily food. So everybody was constantly starving and trying to find ways to get other food, and there was a whole black market going on. In Terezin, where you could, for example, if you were a painter, paint a sketch and give it to one of the bakers who had higher rank, and they might be able to slip you some extra food.
How long did this exist, Lise?
Yeah, approximately 1942 to 1945.
3 years. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, the Nazis' families lived there. Did some of the inmates teach music and culture to the kids that were from the Nazi families?
I've not read any accounts as such. I do know that the kids in the children's barracks that were Jewish were, there was a children's barracks, a woman's barracks, and a men's barracks, so the families were separated. Mm-hmm. And often parents would send their children, although children could stay with their mothers until they were 8 or 9, I believe, they often sent their children to the children's barracks because people were very protective of the children. So the artists would sneak into the children's barracks in order to teach music. The intellectuals would sneak in order to teach the children in hopes that if anybody survived, it would be them, and they would be able to carry on knowledge and art.
You said you came across this speaking with Peter Julian. How long have you been interested in this? That was the first introduction to Terezinstadt.
It was my first introduction to Terezinstadt, which is why I came aboard. I'm always most intrigued when I come into a world that I have not had any exposure to before as a director.
And, of course, compared to some of the other stuff that you've done, I mean, use Tommy as an example, certainly quite quite different, yet the music, how is music supposed to move you as you see this play?
Oh, I think, that's it, precisely why this works as a musical, because, yes, there's musical comedy, but then there's also, Les Mis. There, music can stir, it is very difficult to talk about the Holocaust. It is very difficult to portray people inside of that story in any way that reaches a contemporary audience. We have a lot of knowledge of what happened in the Holocaust and that it was terrible. It's like watching the Titanic, right? It's like, it's terrible. And yet, to try to get at the story of the people, music allows their souls to open up and opens up our souls in return so we can actually see the specifics of not the Holocaust, capital H, but people operating in incredible circumstances and trying to not only survive, but to change the course of what's happening to them and their community.
And I think it's hard to talk about the Holocaust, at least because it's, you can't believe the horror of it. There's one story worse than the next.
Exactly, and at the time people didn't believe it. I mean, interestingly, rumors were floating around Terezin that there was this place called Auschwitz, and what was happening in Auschwitz. But many residents of Terezin, or I should say inmates of Terezin, didn't believe it. And when the reports first went out into the world, people didn't believe it. It just seemed so incredibly evil.
Now, the story behind it, Virginia Christie, she had grandparents who spent their final years at Theresienstadt?
Virginia Christie's parents died in Auschwitz, but they spent their, you know, about a year and a half, 2 years, I think, before that in Terezin before they were shipped to Auschwitz, yeah. So she was researching her grandparents and came upon Terezin, and that's the first she'd heard of the story.
And
when she went there, it was, you know, now there's a museum, but when she went there, she was kind of rooting through closets and found all this artwork.
Mm-hmm.
And managed to get rights to it, and from that came her idea to commission a piece.
Oh, interesting. And what's interesting, too, is I think that your team has put together post-show discussions with Holocaust survivors. Tell us
that's
a little
right.
bit about that. Boy, that's really fascinating.
It's very exciting, and, you know, I mean, I think this piece comes from Virginia Christie's soul.
Mm-hmm.
It comes from her heart, and she wants it to be a space not only to see a profoundly moving piece, but a space where people can talk about their and understand better the specifics of the people inside the Holocaust, outside of the capital H Holocaust, who was there and what was their story. Because that's really how we honor the history. You know, the history books will give us the big story, but it's the people. It's understanding the people and their hearts and their souls that really gives homage.
And she will be there on October 27th.
She will indeed.
Wow, that's a great date to visit. And Fritzi Fritschel, who is the survivor and president of the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center, will be there chatting too.
Yeah, I think we've got a really fantastic group of people coming to open up a discussion with the audience. I think it's going to be a very special day.
And to have this at that theater, that space there, which lends itself to the intimacy that you need for something like this, almost gives you the feeling that you're participatory in the whole process.
It's an interesting space because it's both intimate and large. The stage is quite large, like a Broadway, like a musical stage would be. It's quite lateral, and then the audience, if you're close, it's quite intimate. If you're further back, even though it's only 250 seats, further back it's kind of spread out, so you really feel like you're watching a big old musical. So you have kind of two different experiences depending on where you're sitting. Both of them, I hope, good ones.
Well, I'm sure it's going to get a good response. And what's next up for Lisa Portis?
I'm doing a wonderful piece with American Blues Theater called Grounded, and it's a great piece about a woman pilot in the Gulf War who is then later becomes a drone pilot, and it's a fantastic story of it's a solo show. It's a fantastic story of her journey.
Is that Susie Petrie's group?
The American Blues Theater?
Yeah.
I believe so.
Yeah. Very great cabaret singer in Chicago. The authors take a heartbreaking time in world history and turn it into a human story, a story infused with the life, spirit, and even humor of the people who lived these events. And when people see signs of life, they see the emotion and humanity of this piece. As a ghetto filled with artists, musicians, and thespians, among others, a great deal of artwork arose from Theresienstadt that still exists today. Signs of Life incorporates a number of pieces from the original artwork, and we want to use the visuals available to us to help tell the story, commented Virginia Christie. It's a story about what it's like to be caught in a web of tyranny and deception, and what people do mentally and emotionally to survive it.
Mm.
We want people to see it not only as a Holocaust story, but as a human story, concluded Virginia Christie. Very interesting, Lise, and certainly something that everybody should be participatory in and see. And again, Signs of Life, A Tale of Terezin, is thrilled to announce the full cast for its Chicago premiere this fall at the Zacek McVeigh Theater, Biograph, 2433 North Lincoln. Signs of Life will play Chicago for a limited 6-week engagement September 18th through October 27th. On the line with us right now is the director of Signs of Life, Lisa Portis. Lisa, I'm going to give a phone number for people who would like to get some information, 773-871-3000. I appreciate you taking a little time and getting the word out, and hope we've done that a little bit and certainly piqued people's interest, because it's certainly a great evening in the theater. So many times you go to the theater, you kind of leave and go, geez, I don't know how I spent the last hour and a half. But here I think you'll know why, and certainly it'll certainly engender more information and certainly more conversation and discussion.
Thank you so much, Kevin, for having us. And, you know, just one last thing. It is there are moments of great joy and fun in this musical. And so I look forward to an audience checking it out.
Just for our own edification, time frame as far as age group goes, what do you think?
Say 12 and up. I think I have a 10-year-old daughter, and I'm not quite sure. There's some rougher sections.
Mm-hmm. Well, good luck, and say hello to our friends at DePaul for us.
Will indeed, and thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Lisa.
Take care.
Lisa Portis, the director of a very, very interesting new play musical coming at the Biograph, The Signs of Life, A Tale of Terezin, a story about the human spirit, I guess you would say, and the concentration camp at Theresienstadt. A musical, but certainly something that touches us all, certainly something we should all be aware of. You know, you think about what's happening in Syria and so forth, and what those same people who work for the Red Cross have seen when they've gone over there. Not dissimilar, I mean, to the extent that, of course, they've seen in the Holocaust, but need to get the word out. And directors and actors and talented people like Lisa and her team are doing just that. So at the Zacek McVeigh Theater, the Biograph, 2433 North Lincoln, September 18th through October 27th. For information, 773-871-3000. Signs of Life, A Tale of Terezin. Spring blooms for 100 years. The Joffrey Ballet opens its 2013-2014 season with a special engagement celebrating the Rite of Spring, Centennial in Russian Masters. At Chicago's Auditorium Theater, four performances only, September 19th through the 22nd. The Joffrey Ballet kicks off its 2013-2014 Masters of Dance season with a special addition to its home engagement lineup, a one-weekend-only program titled Russian Masters, celebrating the centennial Vaslav Nijinsky's groundbreaking 1913 ballet Le Sac du Printemps, The Rite of Spring, alongside George Balanchine's Allegro Brillante and two works by Yuri Posokov, the Chicago premiere of Adagio, and the return of his 2011 Joffrey Commission's Bells. These four powerful works by Russian choreographers and composers are presented in four performances only in the Joffrey's home venue, the historic Auditorium Theater of Roosevelt University in downtown Chicago at 50 East Congress Parkway, September 19th through the 22nd. Before 1913, much of European and American culture was understood to be a continuation of classical and romantic traditions, noted Ashley Weider, Joffrey Ballet Artistic Director. The creation of Le Sac du Printemps pointed to the advent of modernism. If not a fully break from the past, at least this collaboration between Stravinsky, Nijinsky, and Rourke reveals the aspirations of the age, to idealize certain aspects of our primitive history, to explore uncharted artistic frontiers, to see ourselves reflected in a shattered mirror. At nearly the same time, Pablo Picasso was distorting the subject of Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, and closer to home, Frank Lloyd Wright was constructing his Unity Temple. These icons are familiar today, but it's not hard to imagine how they surprised the early 20th century mind. Buildings and paintings last for ages. With dance and music, we remember best by witnessing a live performance. And on the line with us right now is the award-winning star of stage, screen, and television, world-renowned dancer having performed with the legendary Rudolf Nureyev and Margot Fonteyn, teacher, mentor, member of the Royal Ballet, former ballet master of the San Francisco Ballet, visionary in the world of dance, and the artistic director of the world-renowned Joffrey Ballet, now presenting Russian Masters for 1 week only, September 19th through the 22nd at the Auditorium Theater of Roosevelt University, 50 East Congress at Michigan, our good pal, Mr. Ashley Weider. Ashley, welcome back to the Kevin Moore Show.
Thank you so much, Kevin. How are you?
I have boned up on Le Sac du Printemps, and I am looking forward to chatting about The Rite of Spring, of course, a great, great piece of work and has spanned the ages. You are reviving it for us.
We are. You know, I think it's quite amazing is that, you know, the 100th anniversary of the work. And the thing about the Joffrey and having this, you know, original idea of what Nijinsky choreographed, it has been restaged by Millicent Hodgson, and her husband Kenneth Archer is the art historian who has painstakingly researched the scenic elements and the costumes. And so I think that, you know, and what we learn from history, and it is quite a spectacle. And I think that, you know, people are very familiar with Stravinsky's, you know, groundbreaking score, but a lot of people, you know, never really knew what the intention choreographically was for the work. So back in 1987, when I was still dancing at the Joffrey, Robert Joffrey wanted to bring back what he called a lost ballet, to see what all the fuss was about. Because when it premiered, there was a lot of controversy around it. And I think what is interesting 100 years later is there's still some controversy around it.
Interesting the way it all came about. Here you have Diaghilev, who was a innovative producer of ballet and opera, and he wanted to bring Russian art and culture to the West. So he goes to Paris and the Paris Theater, where he puts on this, of course, monumental work, The Rite of Spring, with Nijinsky, who happened to be, for a time, his lover, correct?
His lover and his principal dancer. Nijinsky was, in his day, probably what we would consider Rudolf Nureyev to have been in the 70s and 80s, and then Mikhail Baryshnikov in the 80s and 90s. So he was really the dancer of the day. And I think what's really interesting, too, Kevin, is that, you know, ballet began in France, and that's why our language is all in French when we're teaching. And yet we have received more from Russia in terms of bringing an inspiration in terms of music and dance, and particularly ballet, and how Marius Petipa created all these incredible ballets. So it was interesting for Diaghilev to bring his company to Paris and really be a collaborative force at that time in the arts.
And he had the vision to bring the young Stravinsky, who he had worked with on both The Firebird and Petrushka, to write this particular music, and it made him famous.
It certainly did. And I think that, you know, when you read back in the history books that, you know, Stravinsky was not enamored with having to work with Nijinsky. And yet Diaghilev, who was the impresario and the head of the company, was insisting that this move forward. I think it was really Rorik and Stravinsky's idea to have this Rite of Spring. And then Diaghilev said, well, Nijinsky is going to choreograph it. And I think even before it premiered, there was controversy over Nijinsky, not as a dancer, but as his choice as a choreographer, because he had done Afternoon of a Faun, La Première en Faun,
right.
And it had been quite a stir because of the sexual content of it. And so there were people that were not that happy anyway with what Nijinsky was producing choreographically. And so I think that what happened was, when it premiered on the opening night 100 years ago from today, or from this year, people were very upset and disturbed, and it wasn't what they thought going to the ballet was about.
Why wouldn't Stravinsky want the greatest ballet dancer of the time to perform his work? I would think that would be your first choice. It would be Baryshnikov or it would be Nureyev. So why wouldn't you want Nijinsky?
I think because he was very temperamental.
Okay.
I think that the relationship between Nijinsky and Diaghilev was quite controversial.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, I think, just a lot of drama. And I think, you know, he clearly was inexperienced. But having said that, when you look at the production that we have today, which is the closest to the original that you can get, you can see that Nijinsky was really trying to honor the complexity of Stravinsky's music. So I give him credit for really trying, and I think that there are some brilliant design and pattern and rhythmic force on the stage. But having seen many other ideas of Le Sacre du Printemps over the years, I have to say that, you know, for a piece of music that is 37 minutes long, and to sustain it, it's very, very difficult. And I think in some ways, I think that it's still really an amazingly compelling piece of work. I think for some of our audience, it's the same thing that happened back in 1913. They came to see the ballet, or they came to see the Joffrey Ballet, expecting us to be a ballet company. And Sacre is a very ritualistic, tribal piece of work. And I think that for a lot of people, it's just a jarring kind of moment when they realize that they're not going to see, you know, ethereal ladies in toe shoes and men lifting them around. It's very equal. Women's strength is equal to men's strength. And it's very native.
It seems like Rorik, Nicholas Rorik, who did the stage designs and the costumes. He was kind of the glue, it seemed like, held it all together. He was a Russian expert on folk art and ancient rituals, which plays into what Stravinsky and Nijinsky are doing in this particular ballet.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, at that period of time with the World's Fair in Paris, where people had become fascinated with the Orient, with Slavic tribal ritual, and how did other cultures live. And I think that that was part of the attraction to make this basically a Slav. It seems to me very Slavic, although some people say, well, it has quite a few nods to Native American Indians. So it's, you know, Rorik, I think, was the one that said it should reflect a real tribal ritual.
Well, the subtitle of the piece is Pictures of Pagan Russia in Two Parts.
Right.
So there is a bit of that basic dance to it. And I would think that with the way this is put together and the way that all these different personalities come together, it's remarkable that there wasn't more of an uproar about it.
No, it's true. You know, it's very interesting, Kevin, because when it premiered, I think it only had 5 performances in Paris. And then it went on to London, and I think it had a further 9 performances. And every, you know, people were fascinated by the music and by the scenic elements. They just were not riveted by the choreography. And so that kind of fell away, but obviously the Rorik designs, and we know Stravinsky's score, you know, was transformative at the beginning of the 20th century. And so when Joffrey, you know, wanted to find out what choreographically fit with this piece of music, Millicent and Robert Joffrey talked for years about wanting to do it, and Millicent probably spent about 13 years studying it and talking to Mary Rambert, who then founded the Rambert Dance Company in London. But at the time, she was the ballet mistress on Le Sacre. And so she had a lot of really great information to give about it.
You know, I find it interesting here, too, Ashley, is when all this is going on, you talk about Stravinsky, and Stravinsky's father was a contemporary of Rimsky-Korsakov and Borodin and Mussorgsky and so forth. It's during the time of the Romanov dynasty and the Bolshevik Revolution and the time of Lenin and so forth. How did the political climate affect what was going on artistically and culturally in the world of dance in Russia at the time?
Well, I think that, you know, that is why Diaghilev wanted to leave. And I think that that's why that he realized in Europe, bring his company to Europe, and people like Rorik and Stravinsky and many others, they would have much more artistic freedom, you know, because they weren't being dictated to in Paris. Whereas I think that at that time there were many things happening in Russia, and we know from Prokofiev and from Shostakovich and many of the great composers of that day that there were stipulations about how things should end, and did it reflect the Soviet mentality, and you know, everything had to have a positive, happy ending. And I know that that was one thing about Romeo and Juliet. It had to have a happy ending. Mm-hmm. Well, since then, you know, we perform Romeo and Juliet as a tragedy and as a tragic ending.
Right.
So there are so many pieces of music and artists that, you know, were dictated as to how it should, what the final plan should be.
You know, you mentioned that ballet started in Paris, yet the transformation goes to Russia, and Russia produces the greatest ballets, the greatest ballet schools of ballet, and the greatest ballet performers. How did that happen?
Do you know, it's really interesting, and I really don't know enough about it, except that, I mean, even to the point that, you know, we have this program, Russian Masters. But then, you know, on October 16th, we have the Joffrey premiere of La Bayadère, the temple dancer, which was by Petipa. And La Bayadère spanned that end of romanticism in ballet into classicism. And it was really the forerunner to Swan Lake. And Bayadère has one of the most you know, memorable white, what we call white acts, where the women are all in white tutus. And that was really the precursor to the white acts in Swan Lake.
So La Bayadera was the precursor to Swan Lake, which precursed Sleeping Beauty and The Nutcracker.
Yes.
By Tchaikovsky.
Yes.
Interesting.
So when you think about it, it is quite phenomenal that so much has come out of Russia,
mm-hmm.
and it has influenced the world. And part of the Russian Masters program, having George Balanchine's Allegro Brillante, which is truly a tour de force, and then having a young choreographer like Yuri Pozhikov, who grew up in Russia, danced as a principal dancer at the Bolshoi, and then he and I danced at San Francisco Ballet together. Yuri has always wanted to choreograph, and I think that he brings a very deep soul, a deep passion to his work. And so I was thinking when I was putting this program together, you know, that we have been greatly inspired by other influences in the world. And I think that as this is a great anniversary for La Sacra, it's also a great way to honor, you know, people like George Balanchine, who I think most people do know who he is.
And this is kind of interesting for the Joffrey. This is like, what would you call, a little antipasti or a little amuse-bouche before the main menu comes with the Joffrey program for the year, having the Russian Masters offered at the beginning of the year like this.
Well, it's a really wonderful way for us to be able to add an additional program. And we're very, very grateful, Kevin, to Alphawood Foundation, because they have made this possible. And I think that we heard from a lot of subscribers that there was just too big a gap between seeing the Joffrey. And so I can tell you that the program has just sold incredibly well. And I think that it's a way to say, what is the breadth of the Joffrey? It's always been an eclectic company. And I think that you can come and see this program, Russian Masters, and then you can see La Bayadere, and then, of course, there's the Nutcracker. And then we have a contemporary program with Christopher Wilden and Alexander Ickman and Brock Clawson. And then we have a new production of Romeo and Juliet. So I think that when you look at our year, it really does show you the breadth and depth of, one, the ballet world, but also what the Joffrey Ballet can take on.
And it's a great year for love stories. You would consider The Rite of Spring a love story, certainly La Bayadere, and certainly Romeo and Juliet.
Definitely.
I have to share a little secret with you, though. I talked to Brian yesterday. I had him go through with me to make sure I was pronouncing Le Sac du Printemps the right way. He helped me out with that. So
well, it's very good. It's very well.
Well, it's going to be a great only four days, but certainly a very exciting 4 days. And I think people look forward to it. As you said, La Bayadere is coming up next. And the date for that, October 16th through the 27th?
Yes, absolutely. And the other thing, Kevin, is that, you know, we have the Chicago Philharmonic as our partner. And so I think that musically, the Russian Masters program is pretty stunning, because you have Tchaikovsky's third unfinished piano concerto. You have this new adagio choreographed by Yuri Pozhikov to the Kachaturian adagio from Spartacus. Then you have Rachmaninoff piano for Bells, which we premiered in 2011. And then La Sacra with Stravinsky. So musically, it's an amazingly rich program. And I think the same for La Bayadere. The music is by Minkus, who was a German who lived his life in Russia and wrote so much ballet music. But I think that of all the scores that he's written, I think La Bayadere is the most lush and fulfilling.
Something to look forward to. And some other special things we want to chat about is you have the Joffrey got a special surprise the last few weeks from the Rudolf Nureyev Foundation.
We did. It is truly an amazing gift in so many ways. The Rudolf Nureyev Dance Foundation believes that the Joffrey has really established a solid foundation, you know, to develop into a premier ballet company, and that it can represent itself in Chicago and then nationally and internationally. And so in the spirit of making that a reality and facilitating our development, they have presented us with a $500,000 challenge grant, which will be an endowment for the Joffrey in order to continue to create new full-length story works for the 21st century.
Oh, that's exciting. It must have been very exciting for you to receive that.
It really is. And I think particularly that, you know, growing up and Rudolf Nureyev having given me my first opportunity to dance the prince in his version of Sleeping Beauty, and I was in the Nutcracker and I danced Benvolio opposite his Romeo. So, you know, for 3 years he coached me and gave me so much, and you know, I'm really, really thrilled about this, and I'm also really proud. And, you know, there is another Russian who has, you know, left an indelible mark on the ballet world, and even in his death, for him to have left his estate in order to further the art form and companies, I think is just, it's pretty amazing.
But isn't it the circle of life? Actually, he did so much for you, and you now are doing the same for the people of Chicago.
I hope so. I mean, that's the way I think about it, Kevin, and I think that, you know, it's a great responsibility and one I take very seriously, because I think that, you know, dance and ballet at its greatest is such a compelling art form. And, you know, like anything, I mean, you can go to an amazing football club and you can appreciate the skill of what they're doing, or a tennis match, and dance when it's at that high level has the same impact. So I think that we have a gloriously talented company who are working extremely hard and who have really taken on all the many facets of their art form to bring, you know, some excellent performances to Chicago.
And also another surprise, a new executive director, Mr. Greg Cameron.
Yes. Which is fantastic news. I think Greg comes with a stellar record. He is a man of, I would say, what I would say about Greg Cameron is he has great integrity. He has been in the not-for-profit world for 30 years in Chicago at the Art Institute, at the Museum of Contemporary Art, at WTTW. And I just cannot tell you, it's wonderful to have a great partner in order to, you know, continue to look at the longevity of the Joffrey Ballet. So it is a fantastic addition. We're all very thrilled.
Only wonderful, bright things ahead for the Joffrey, Ashley.
I hope so.
The Joffrey Ballet, Chicago's premier ballet company, committed to artistic excellence and innovation, presenting a unique repertory encompassing masterpieces of the past and cutting-edge works of today. Founded by visionary teacher Robert Joffrey in 1956, guided by celebrated choreographer Gerald Arpino from 1988 until 2007, the Joffrey Ballet continues to thrive under artistic director Ashley Weider and executive director Greg Cameron. The Joffrey is also committed to providing arts education and accessible dance training through its Joffrey Academy of Dance and Community Engagement Programs. The Joffrey Ballet kicks off its 2013-2014 Masters of Dance season with a special addition to its home engagement lineup, a one-weekend-only program titled Russian Masters, celebrating the centennial of Vaclav Nijinsky's groundbreaking 1913 ballet Le Sac du Printemps, The Rite of Spring, alongside George Balanchine's Allegro Brillante and two works by Yuri Posokov, the Chicago premiere of Adagio, and the return of his 2011 Joffrey Commission Bells. These four powerful works by Russian choreographers and composers are presented in four performances only in the Joffrey's home venue, the historic Auditorium Theater of Roosevelt University in downtown Chicago at 50 East Congress Parkway, September 19th through the 22nd. And, of course, for information, 800-982-2787 on the line with us right now is our good pal, Mr. Ashley Weider. Ashley, always a pleasure. I find it so intellectually and culturally stimulating to chat about ballet with you, and I always look forward to it.
Well, Kevin, I appreciate that we have an opportunity to let your listeners know what we're up to, and really, it's I appreciate all your support, and it's a great relationship. So, thank you very much.
You're a dear friend. Look forward to chatting with La Bayadere.
Okay, fantastic.
Take care, my friend.
All right. Thanks so much, Kevin.
Thank you, Ashley.
Bye bye.
Ashley Weider, one of the VIPs of Chicago, theater and music and dance, and certainly a visionary in the world of dance, the artistic director of the world-renowned Joffrey Ballet, now presenting Russian Masters for one weekend only, September 19th to the 22nd at the Auditorium Theater of Roosevelt University, 50 East Congress at Michigan. For information, 800-982-2787, Le Sac du Printemps, The Rite of Spring. Of course, Nijinsky and Diaghilev and Stravinsky's great work, celebrating 100 years, 1913, first debuted at the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées in May of 1913. The avant-garde nature of the music and choreography caused a sensation and a near riot in the audience. I don't think that'll be the case here in Chicago, but certainly it'll be worthwhile seeing. So again, for 4 days only, and for information, 800-982-2787. Always a pleasure chatting with Ashley. Well, that about does it for our show today. I thank you for sharing this last hour with me and hope you, our listeners, have enjoyed this time as much as I have. I'd especially like to thank our guest, Lisa Portis, the award-winning director, now presenting the Chicago premiere of Signs of Life, A Tale of Tirzan, at the Zacek McVeigh Theater at the Biograph, 2433 North Lincoln, through October 27th. For information, 773-871-3000. Very powerful, dramatic musical, something that we all need to see and remember. And finally, Ashley Weider, our good pal, the artistic director of the world-renowned Joffrey Ballet, now presenting Russian Masters for one weekend only, September 19th through the 22nd at the Auditorium Theater of Roosevelt University, 50 East Congress in Michigan, 800-982-2787 for tickets. The 100th anniversary of Le Sac du Printemps, The Rite of Spring. Stravinsky's great work, danced and choreographed by Nijinsky, certainly brought to Paris by Diaghilev, something that we need to see because it's not always available to us here. And Joffrey does it, as usual, better than ever. It's always a pleasure to chat with our good pal Ashley. Finally, a famous writer once said, one ought every day at least to hear a little song, read a good poem, see a fine picture, and if it were possible, to speak a few reasonable words. I hope on our show today we have at the very least done just that, spoken a few reasonable words. At that, I'd like to wish everyone a good week, and as that British group once said, and in the end, the love that you take is equal to the love that you make. Have a great last weekend of summer. See you next week.
Forever, forever. If we can be the best of lovers, yet be the best of friends. If we can try with every day to make it better as it grows, any luck then I suppose. The music, the music.